to thank the organizer, especially Michael Lacey, for the invitation to come to this conference. And it's a very good one. I enjoy it, and it's worth traveling from Australia, leave the summer there to enjoy the winter in Toronto. Okay. So my talk today is about bodiness of which transform for magnetic shoring operators. But I hope that you can see the the technique that we work here can be used for different cases as well, not just this which transform. So let me remind you about the definition of the magnetic Schrodinger operators. And you start with the real vector potential A, and you have a potential V. The assumption is the AK is the L2 function local, and V is non-negative, but L1 local. So you can see that I try to keep the assumption on AK and V to a minimum. You define LK and the form Q using the standard form Q acting on UV given by this expression, with the domain, the appropriate domain of Q appropriate domain of Q given by U in L2, such that LK acting on U is also in L2, square root of V times U is in L2. And look at the self-adjoint operator A associated with Q. So A of U is given by this expression or this one. So if the special case, if A here equal to 0, then you see it's the usual Schrodinger operators. And the potential V here is a function of X. Keep in your mind that I only assume it is L1 local. Of course, the A defined from the form Q, then we get the domain of A using the domain of Q like that. So this is just a standard way to define the magnetic Schrodinger operators. Now, we look at the Weiss transform. So the Weiss transform R sub k is the LK composite with A minus 1/2. So let me remind you that the LK is, you have two terms here, the time derivative, the space derivative here, and minus I times AK. Once you look at the Weiss transform, then if you want to check the boundedness of the Weiss transform on L2, then it's easy, because you just use the corresponding definition of the form Q, you put that in, you perform some iteration by parts and this and that, and you get it. So there's no problem with the boundedness of the Weiss transform on L2. The next question is, how about the boundedness in LP? So let me list the main result first, and then I will try to explain a little bit on the proof or some of the main problem when we try to prove the boundedness in LP. Okay, so the first result is the Weiss transform is bounded from the Hardy space H1A. So this is not the standard Hardy space. This is the Hardy space associated to the operator A itself. It's bounded from H1A into L1. So if you look at the It means that the L1 norm of the restraint form acting on U is less than the H1 norm of U. And then by interpolation, what you obtain is that the restraint form, they are all bounded on LP for P in between 1 and 2. The next result is if you consider BMO function, let's say it is B, then if you take the commutators of B and the restraint form, then you also have it bounded on LP for P in between 1 and 2. Yes, the classical BMO. In the next overhead, I will write out the definition. I will explain the Hardy space then. Okay. Is it clear or should I adjust that? Okay.
Could you extend it by
blood
be greater than
2? No. I will come to that problem later. Now, let's see the problem that we have in hand. So, when you have Schrodinger operators or magnetic Schrodinger with non-negative potential, then what you can get is the heat kernel bound of the semi-loop E minus TA because of domination. Then we have the heat kernel bound is less than the heat kernel of the Laplace operator on Rn. So we have this estimate. But that's all that we have. If you put more condition on the potential V, the Hölder class and this and that, then you get more estimate. The reverse Hölder class and this and that, you can get some estimate on the space derivative and this and that. But under the assumption of the V on the L1 local, then we don't have anything more than the upper bound like that. Now, at this formally means with appropriate function. Yes, that's right. sorry. If you write a minus 1/2 as this integration for appropriate function u, then you look at the restraint form, then the LK acting on a minus 1/2 means you put the LK in there. Keep in your mind that the LK there, you have two terms in there. One is the space derivative. Another term is minus A times A sub K. And we don't have much condition on the A sub K. It's just L2 local or something like that. So it's going to be discontinuous. So if you look at the kernel of the R sub K, then the kernel of this, you just replace the semi-loop here by the kernel PTXY. So this is just the associated kernel. But you look at here, the expression, then all we have in hand is some upper bound on the PTXY. And that's all. If you want the pointwise, you don't even have the pointwise bound on the space derivative acting on the PT there. Okay? Or because the AK here it's non-smooth, you times it, then you can see that it destroyed the smoothness of the P of the PT. If you have any, but you don't have in this case. So from the beginning, if you look at the pointwise bound on the kernel of the restraint form, then it's very far from the standard condition that we need for Kondrup-Zsigmond operator, so that you can apply the Hofmeister condition or something like that. It doesn't work. Right, so that's the problem. Now, if you have the operator is to be quantum signal, then you can you want the bias on LP. What you can do is either you prove that it is weak type 1-1, or you can show that it's bounded from the standard Hardy space into L1. Then you interpolate, you get the boundedness for OLP in between 1 and 2. So, but now you don't. So let me remind you the definition of the classical Hardy space, H1. There are many equivalent characterizations. I choose one of them only. So the L1 function f is in H1 if and only if you take this this area integral, the standard one. I choose a very specific here. This is the standard Laplace operator in Rn. So this is t times the time derivative of the semi loop here. And this is the standard one that we have. I choose this one so that you can see the standard H1 is a very nice function space. It has so many characterizations. It is so nice, and we use it in so many cases successfully. But somehow, the space is characterized by the Laplace operator. It's associated to that. So it is a nice space, but our weak transform in this case, it is a bad one. So the situation is a bad one, doesn't behave well in a nice space. That's the problem. But it might behave well in a different kind of space. So we define a Hardy space associated to A by just replace the Laplace operator here by A itself. Okay, what we know about A here in this case is that A, because it's self-adjoint, so it has functional calculus bounded on L2, holomorphic functional calculus. You even have more than that. You have bounded measurable function is enough, and then you have the heat kernel bound as well. Okay, so we define a new Hardy space, and what happened is the weak transform associated to A is a bad one, but it behaves very well on the space associated to itself. And then the key point is at the end, we can still interpolate between the Hardy space H1A with the usual L2, and we obtain the bounds on LP for OP in between 1 and 2. Okay? That's the main idea. So once we define using the area integral like that, then we use the technique of tensor space. Tao Mei mentioned something on that in his talk on the first day. Just apply it in this case. We also obtain a molecule decomposition as well. But what we obtain in this case is not the same as the usual decomposition. For example, we might lose, it depends on the A, but we might lose the property like the average of the function is zero for the function in Hardy space. We no longer have that. It has some cancellation with respect to A, but not the average equal to zero. Okay, so we define this Hardy space, and we get the decomposition. Let me comment a little bit more on the Hardy space here. The advantage of defining the Hardy space is like that, like this, is that you can extend it to many cases. HA, you get a different Hardy space. For example, the classical case, if you take the whole Rn, then you have many characterizations. But if you look at only a domain of Rn, for example, how can you define the Hardy space? You have so many different ways to define. For example, at least you have a domain in Rn, then you can define the Hardy space on the domain of Rn by assuming that if you extend by zero outside the domain, then the new function is a function in Hardy space of the whole of Rn. That's one way to define. You can also define the Hardy space on the domain by saying that, well, we take all the Hardy space of Rn and take the restriction on the domain. And each case, you get a different type of Hardy space. One is small, one is very big. That's the two ends that you can have. So, and you can have many, many in the middle as well. But you use this approach, then instead of having two different things like that, you can prove that if you take A here as a Laplacian with Dirichlet boundary condition and with Neumann boundary condition, then those two cases correspond to the two cases that I just said. And so if you change the Laplacian to mixed boundary condition or something like that, then you get a new Hardy space. It's very convenient. It goes even beyond that because, for example, the way that you define by taking the restriction and this and that, usually people need some condition on the boundary of the domain. Usually we need Lipschitz boundary or something like that. But you see, like, if you look at the Laplace operator on the domain in Rn, well, you can define with Dirichlet boundary condition, you don't need any condition on the boundary. It means you can define the Hardy space on the domain that way, without assumption on the boundary, and it still works perfectly. At least in the case of Dirichlet boundary condition, you see that you can get the heat kernel bound by domination all the time. And it's self-adjoint, so it fits into this. So it's not just in this case, but in many other cases, the approach of using the Hardy space there should help. Now, I wouldn't have enough time to go into the details, so I just tell you a few things, which is that the key idea for the estimate of the restraint form. First of all, the kernel PTXY of the semi-loop has a Gaussian upper bound. We have no control on the space derivative. But if you only take the time derivative, then because the semi-loop is holomorphic, you take the time derivative, then you get the good estimate. So you can see the time derivative means you take E minus TA, time derivative means you get one more A in front. But A there is some kind of derivative as well. You have two derivatives in that. Not one derivative separately, but two derivatives in there. So it means that implicitly, in the fact that the semi-loop is holomorphic, you do have some control, not on the usual space derivative, but on the A acting on the semi-loop. Then it's very nice. So you have this kind of estimate. The next estimate that we can obtain is what I call here is weighted L2 estimate. While you take the PTXY, so the tilde here is just one more term, it doesn't matter, it's similar. The LK here means you remember that we have a space derivative in front, as well the term minus I times A sub K. You take the L2 estimate on that. you put a weight in there, so beta here is a positive constant, small enough, so you get a positive weight in here, exponential term, then you can get the estimate. So what happens here is, if you look at LK acting on the PT, you do not have the pointwise bound, but you do have some bound if you use integration with appropriate weight. You obtain this estimates by some kind of integration by parts, mainly for the inequality, a few things, then you can get it. The reason is because you perform integration by parts, you can make the LK here to become the operator A itself, which gets some estimate using the time derivative. Okay. Well, it takes about one page or something like that, but roughly that's what happens. You have some control on this type of estimate because of the time derivative. You don't need the pointwise space derivative as good pointwise bound. The next thing is our Hardy space, then the molecule decomposition. Once you decompose it, then you can have it something like this. So if a molecule here is alpha, then you can express it like this. And the A here is a standard T12 atom in the 10 space, this, the standard one. But now you have this part as well. Okay? Then once you get that, you want to show that it's bounded on Hardy space into L1, you just take one molecule only, show that it's bounded on when it acts on that. So you take the Ritz transform, you act on alpha, then you take the whole of this expression, put it in the expression of the Ritz transform. And what happened is, you see the Ritz transform. The Ritz transform here. The Ritz transform here expressed in terms of the semi-loop here. You put the expression of the alpha in there, then it also has some expression of the semi-loop in here, and these, you can combine them nicely. For example, if you get E minus TA here, acting on this one, then you see that the SA E minus S, E minus SA here, for example, then you can just say O commu, and E minus TA, E minus SA, you combine, you get E minus T plus SA, something like that. They combine very nicely, and then you can get the appropriate estimate. Okay, and then you the estimate on L1, you break it into two parts. One part on the wall correspond to the atom A, and one part is outside, and the part the local part, you use the L2 norm of the Ritz transform, and the L2 norm estimate on the L on the alpha means the L2 norm of the A there, and the number 2 there, you use the weighted L2 estimate roughly, so it takes 2-3 pages of something like that to get it. So that's roughly is what I can tell you about the proof. I have only 3-4 minutes. So, about the proof of the commutator, then that relies on more standard thing. You still have the usual function in BMO, and it's rely on some type of lambda inequality, certain estimate of maximum function or something like that. You have to choose the right one, and it follows the more of the standard stuff. We didn't get the endpoint estimate for the commutator. We only get the boundedness from 1 to 2. As some note here, we can show that the Ritz transform is also of type 1-1, hence bounded on LP for P in between 1 and 2 as well. Hardy space H1A, but we can show it using the weak type 1-1 by using the weighted L2 estimate, then it's also possible. This here an open problem is that we study the L2 boundedness for the restraint form for P greater than 2. Then what I believe is if you want a positive result for P greater than 2, we need more information about the heat kernel. The upper bound only will not be enough for us to obtain for the case P greater than 2. The restraint form is not symmetric between P less than 2 and P greater than 2. And in that case, I believe that we need to impose more condition on the potential V. Then we should be able to obtain, it depends on the V, we should be able to obtain the boundedness on LP up to some P, not P1, maybe depends on the dimension. And the last here is some some reference, then the Hardy space is in this preprint. I'm sorry, it's still a preprint for a long time. The estimate on the on the magnetic Schrodinger, the restraint form is appear in the archive in 2006, near the end of 2006, and the commutator estimate is another preprint. If any of you want to see that, then after the talk, I can try to get a copy for you then. Thank you. I haven't tried that estimate, but maybe it's possible.
And how about you add a space derivative to your
H1?
Do you think
that space? What do you mean, space?
Because only time derivative.
I believe that if you replace the time derivative of the H1, the H1 that I define here, see, the H1 that I define here, using TA here means the time derivative. Okay? If you replace it by the space derivative, I think you mess it up. The reason is, I mean, the time derivative of the semi-loop here, as I pointed out, because the semi-loop is holomorphic, then if you take the whole thing here, then you know at least the whole stuff here has a heat kernel bound. I mean, a Gaussian upper bound as well. You get a good estimate here. If you look at the space derivative, I think it's completely different. And you get a totally new space, and I'm not sure if that space is useful in any estimate because you mess it up.
I'm not sure you use the European mode.
You mean that change the B to the B to my BMO? You mean that you want to ask me what happens when I change the function B in the standard BMO into the new BMO? Is that correct?
Yeah, do you have definition of the new BMO?
Yes, I do. I do have some definition of the BMO associated to operator A. And it's a whole two papers or something like that. Yes, we we have the Hardy space associated to the operator A. We have the BMO associated to the operator A, and we can define, and we can show that the BMO associated to A is a dual space of the Hardy space as well. But that will be a whole different thing, and it takes much more time. Yes. What happened is the new BMO associated to A, it depends on A, then it can be larger than the standard BMO, it can be smaller, it can have some intersection, but they are not the same, so all the things will be happen.
So if we define
Well, so you look at the BMO, then you know the H1S as well. It depends on the A. It can be smaller. If the semi-loop has the property of the of if it is conservative, means the semi-loop acting on 1 is 1. E minus TA acting on 1 is 1. If it has that conservative property, then the new BMO, the new Hardy space is smaller than the usual Hardy space. It means that we gain something in here because the new Hardy space is smaller than the standard Hardy space. It means it's easier to show that it's bounded from the new Hardy space into L1. But go back to Tao Mei's question that, if you take the case that the semi-loop acting on 1 is 1, it means it's the semi-loop is conservative, then the new Hardy space is smaller than the standard Hardy space, so the new BMO is bigger than the usual BMO. And if you can show the commutator with the B there, it's also true, it means you get something more. But I haven't tried that. It's a reasonable question. I haven't tried it.